Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. Welcome to another edition of The Big Picture. I am A.B. Dauji. Well, this is the program in which we look at what's lurking behind the headlines of the mainstream media. We deconstruct the conspiracy theories. We lampoon the clowns who masquerade as world leaders. We deliver a sharp kick to the warmongers and war criminals, and generally look at the world of international politics with a jaundiced eye, and of course, a somewhat irreverent eye. I like that word, irreverent. I just checked it up in the dictionary this morning, and I thought I'll use it in this program, which means we look at international politics with no particular respect to all the chores who are lurking there. Irreverent, no respect. So, there you have it, folks. That's what The Big Picture is all about. And as usual, we begin by looking at the crazy, the bizarre, the weird, and wonderfully silly stories that made it into the mainstream media. The United States, as you all know, is well known for lawsuits that are, well, laughable. People sue for ridiculous reasons. It's called tatama chance. They sue usually big companies, hoping for an out-of-court settlement or perhaps even success in the courts. Sometimes they cash in and sometimes they are told to futsack. The most famous case concerns McDonald's. Here is the story. In February 1992, Stella Liebeck ordered a cup of coffee to go, from McDonald's. To go means, of course, takeaway. Takeaway cup of coffee. Liebeck was sitting in the passenger seat of her nephew's car, which was pulled over so she could add sugar to her coffee. Now, while removing the cup's lid, Liebeck spilt her hot coffee, burning her legs. It was determined that Liebeck suffered third-degree burns on over 60% of her body. Originally, Liebeck wanted $20,000 in damages. McDonald's refused to settle out of court. However, they should have settled out of court. Liebeck was ultimately awarded $200,000 in compensatory damages, which was reduced to $160,000 because she was found to be 20% at fault. She was also awarded $2.7 million in punitive damages. Well, dear listeners, the $2.7 million equals, let's see now if I can work it out very quickly, $37,727,775. Isn't that amazing, eh? $37 million. And let's leave it at $37 million. And that's for a cup of coffee. And now I've got the latest one for you. It's about a watermelon. No, it did not fall on somebody's lap or somebody's head. 59-year-old Henry Walker went shopping to Walmart. Now, there was a huge display of watermelons. The watermelons were stacked on a wooden pallet. And Henry reached across to pick a watermelon. His foot got stuck into the pallet and he fell. So he decided to sue Walmart. Let's read from the Huffington Post. It says, Walker's attorney, Sean O'Hara, said the injury permanently changed his client's life. He used to play basketball 3 days a week and now must use a walker to get around. Walker sued Walmart for negligence and wantonness, arguing that the store had not kept its premises reasonably safe. And so, on Wednesday, the jury awarded Walker $2.5 million in compensatory damages and $5 million in punitive damages. Total, $7.5 million in rands. Actually, the figure is $104,850,750. Can you imagine that, eh? 104 million rands. Yes, folks. That is what he got for trying to reach for a watermelon. And I think today, later on, I will be heading off to Macro to see if they have a display of watermelons or maybe bananas or pineapples or anything. As long as it's stacked on a pallet, maybe I will be able to afford the two-door Jaguar that will be launched very soon here in South Africa. And it's got a price tag of, just under R1 million. And of course, I will still have some change left over after I sue Macro or one of the other shops. And so perhaps I could buy my Roxana with the change. I could buy my Roxana a nice piece of jewelry. How's that, eh? And that brings me to a necklace that was sold a few days ago. I will have to go to Game. To buy that necklace, I will have to Game and get my foot stuck in a pallet after Macro and then go to Checkers and then Pick and Pay to make enough to afford such a necklace. This particular one was auctioned recently. Guess what it went for? It was actually auctioned by the famous auction house Christie's at the Four Seasons Hotel in Geneva. Let me give you some background. It says here that the necklace features a giant 163.41 carat colorless diamond, the world's largest of its kind. 18 emerald-cut diamonds adorn one side of the necklace, while emeralds decorate the other. Its centerpiece is the colorless diamond, a D-color, two-type diamond, the rarest and most valuable kind. The diamond was cut from a 404-carat rough rock, which was discovered in February 2016 in the Lulo mine in Angola, the 27th biggest rough white diamond ever discovered. The rough rock was analyzed in Antwerp and cut in New York, where a team of 10 diamond cutting specialists were involved in mapping, plotting, cleaving, laser cutting, and polishing the giant rough rock into a polished, flawless diamond. A team from Swiss luxury jeweler De Grisgono then created 50 different designs around the 163.41 carat diamond before opting for an asymmetric necklace with the stone as its centerpiece. The left side of the necklace is made up of 18 emerald-cut diamonds and the right side composed of two rows of pear-shaped emeralds. And what did it sell for? It sold at the auction on Tuesday for $33.7 million. $33.7 million for that necklace. So there you are, folks. My Roxana missed out on this necklace, but perhaps I would have thought about giving her a painting by a famous artist, like the one that went on auction on Wednesday night at, again, Christie's Auction House in New York. It was by Leonardo da Vinci. The painting is called Salvatore Mundi. How much did it go for? And the answer is $400 million, which is R5,594,960,000. Can you believe it? But you know what? Roxana would not have liked it because it depicted a murat. That's right. If it was some Italian scenery or something like that, then maybe I would have bought it for her. But anyway, where would you hang a painting in your house worth R5 billion? Eh? Luckily, I didn't go to the auction. And now to the next eyebrow-raising story. As you know, listen very carefully, as you know, I travel frequently overseas, and I have to take a flight from Durban to Johannesburg to catch the international flight from O.R. Tambo. Sometimes the flight from Durban can be quite nail-biting. Not because of turbulence, but because suddenly, while you're waiting at the airport, you hear an announcement that your flight is delayed. Sure. Did you ever hear the announcements at airports? I don't know why they don't buy good quality microphones and speakers. The flight number is announced, but it's so unclear, muffled, that you panic because you didn't know whether it was your flight that's been delayed or what. Panic because, well, for me particularly, because I have about 80 people waiting at OR And if I don't get there in time to catch the flight to maybe Uzbekistan or Bosnia or Morocco, khalas, finish. Disaster. And then, while you're waiting at the airport in Durban, you hear something like this.
Ping, 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 ping. This is a special announcement for passengers 30 or 5, 7 and 4. Your flight has been delayed by 2 hours.
Well, you rush to the information desk and yes, you discover it's your flight. Nervous breakdown. You finally make it to Joburg, domestic terminal. And guess what? Your bag is the last one to come out. And you rush over to the international side and you just make it before the check-in counter closes. Heart is beating like crazy. And one uncle, of course, is waiting there with fire coming out of his nostrils because you had his passport with you in Durban. It's all so nerve-wracking. But guess what? Guess what? Not an apology from the local airline for the delay. It's as if they take it as normal. You know what? I'm moving to Japan. Yes, that's right. I'm fed up, fed up. Why Japan, I hear you ask? Because there, there is rarely any kind of delay in the transport system. Very rare indeed. And when there is a delay, passengers are given a full apology. It happened on this last Tuesday. The Tsukuba Express, that's the name of the train, is a privately owned railway firm. That's the name of the company, actually. The train arrived on time at Minami Nagare Yama, which is a town just north of Tokyo. And then passengers got on board, and at 9:44 and 40 seconds, it departed from the station. That was a huge mistake, a major disaster, because it was scheduled to leave exactly at 9:45. And so it left 20 seconds early. What an embarrassment to the company. 20 seconds early! What a disgrace, eh? The Metropolitan Intercity Railway Company that owns this train immediately issued a statement.
We deeply regret. We apologize for the severe inconvenience imposed upon our customers.
So, what do you think of that, folks? Are you coming to Japan with me? Here is something that is guaranteed to bring a big smile to your face. I just came across an article which said that Zuma is going to be put onto a rocket and will be fired out into space. No, I'm very serious, and it's not a joke. I'm very, very serious. I don't ever joke on this program, do I? So, what is this about, I hear you ask? The headlines in yesterday's Times newspaper had this headline. Musk to blast Zuma off into space aboard Falcon rocket. Musk to blast off Zuma off into space aboard Falcon rocket. And the article says Zuma is being launched into space aboard a rocket that was the brainchild of South African-born inventor and businessman Elon Musk. Okay. Before you start celebrating, let me explain. The word Zuma is a code word for a top-secret military package, something that they're putting onto this rocket. It's some sort of military stuff that will be put on board the rocket. The communication director of Northrop Grumman's Space System Division, his name is Lon Raines, said, Northrop Grumman is proud to be a part of the Zuma launch. The rocket or satellite will be orbiting the Earth at a very low altitude. So, dear listeners, after 2019, Jacob Zuma will be gone. But every evening, you can stand outside, you can look up at the sky, and then you know that Zuma is up there forever. What a comforting thought, ne? But you know what? I'm sure that right now many people would like to put one particular character onto a rocket and shoot him out into space. But first, I'm sure you heard the expression, behind every successful man is a woman. Behind every successful man is a woman. Well, I got my own variation to that one. Behind every successful man is a very surprised mother-in-law. very surprised mother-in-law. Hey, you know what? That Rashid fellow was such a washout, eh? Smoking dacha and jumping from one job to another, and my daughter fell for him completely hook, line, and sinker, and we could do nothing about it, but we only could make dua when they got married. But such a surprise now, eh? He went into a building and now he's doing so well. He got 35 people working for him, and his house is so fancy, and I'm staying in the granny cottage. Such a nice son-in-law I got. But back to the expression, behind every successful man is a woman. That is not always true. Robert Mugabe, president of Zimbabwe for 37 years, a powerful man, completely in control, enjoying a great life, but all that was blown away because his wife, Disgrace Mugabe, opened her big mouth and spewed out some very angry words. She said that the vice president was a bad guy. He was planning to topple her husband. But the vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, had powerful contacts in the military, especially among the war veterans. So when Robert Mugabe fired him the next day, all hell broke loose. The army told Mugabe, sorry, bro, it's you who has to go. And so people are waiting to see what will happen. Today there's going to be, as you heard in the news, a big rally in Harare. I'll be watching that one, calling for him to step down, or maybe to step into a rocket that will be fired into space. Sure, imagine that, eh? Robert and Jacob like two shining stars going round and round the earth. Buddies here on earth and united up there in the sky. Shah, magic stuff, eh? And all this because Grace opened her fat mouth and blew everything away. She had ambitions to be vice president, and finally when Robert is gone, she will be president. But she didn't know how much people hated her, especially for her vile temper and her extravagant lifestyle. Many didn't refer to her as the first lady. They nicknamed her First Shopper. It was reported that on one trip to Paris, she spent $75,000. Just multiply that by 14, and you'll get the rand. And she was regularly off to Hong Kong and Singapore for holidays, of course, shopping. So how did she get to be so powerful? Well, I was going to read you a longish article about how they met. It's like a love story. Amazing. And so she caused Mugabe's downfall. A love story. Now, a similar thing happened in Tunisia. That's where the so-called Arab Spring started, if you remember. Zain al-Abidine Ben Ali was the president. His wife, Leila Trabesli, she was from a very poor background, very humble background. She was working as a hairdresser. She was the daughter of a fruit and nut seller. And she had 10 brothers living all in one small little apartment. And, of course, when he saw her, he went crazy. He married her. And that's when things started taking a bad turn. The Trabesli family went crazy. They all became fabulously rich through corruption. It was like a mafia family taking over everything. Anyway, when the revolution came, Ben Ali and Leila had to run for their lives. She, in fact, particularly was hated the most. But before leaving for Saudi Arabia, where they are living right now, Leila went to the central bank of Tunisia and demanded that the governor hand over all the gold bars that were stored there. And he refused. A few minutes later, he got a phone call from President Ben Ali. Hand it over. And so Leila loaded 1.5 tons of gold bars, said to be worth $50 million, onto the plane. And now it's safely stored in some bank in Riyadh. So Grace was hated and Leila was hated. But our Yakubai is not in the same situation. Jacob. No one can blame his wife for his downfall. How are they going to blame his wife for his downfall? Because he's got so many. Who are you going to blame? And speaking about extravagant lifestyles, what do you think is the collective worth of the people staying at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh today? Well, I'll tell you after the break. Yes, the program is called The Big Picture. Now, before the break, I was telling you about the extravagant lifestyle of people at the top. And I asked you the question, what do you think is the collective worth of the people staying at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh today? Well, to be frank, I don't really know. But what I do know is that they are fabulously rich. Rich, very wealthy indeed. But I won't want to be one of them. Because the Ritz-Carlton is a glorified thronk, jail. Yes, these people are prisoners in this wonderful five-star hotel. And if you remember from last week, I said that about 200 princes, cabinet ministers, senior military officers, and wealthy businessmen have been held at this five-star hotel. Well, in fact, they are being held at five-star hotels right across Saudi Arabia. At the Ritz-Carlton, the guests are very big motas, menos, big guys. Let me read again from the Guardian newspaper. It says, the arrests were ordered by King Salman via his son and heir, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Those detained include Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, a billionaire who owns stakes shares in Citigroup and Twitter. Wow, that's big now, you know, to own shares in Twitter. And he is the nephew of King Salman, and he also publicly backed attempts to reform the country. Others include Walid Al Ibrahim, the founder of Middle East Broadcasting Center, which owns the Saudi satellite television channel Al Arabiya, and Bakr bin Laden, who is the chairman of the Saudi bin Laden Construction Company Group. There you are, big boys. So, what was the purpose of arresting these big boys? Well, Salman Bhai said that it was done to fight corruption. And others say that it's a power grab by the Lighty. What's he, 32 years old? Well, as usual, there's a twist in the tale. In fact, it seems like every week there's some sort of a twist in the tale when things come out of Saudi Arabia. Here is the latest development. The Financial Times reported that the Saudi government was demanding up to 70% of the individual's wealth in return for their freedom. All these guys who are locked up in the five-star hotels, the Saudi government wants 70% of their wealth. If settlements are agreed, hundreds of billions of dollars would be diverted into the country's depleted coffers. Saudi Arabia recorded a budget deficit of $79 billion last year, and low oil prices have pushed the country into a recession. Did you get that? Saudi Arabia is in a recession. And so now they're telling these guys here, these big business people, shine up. 70% of your wealth must be contributed to the government coffers. The Financial Times said that, a line before that said, the businessmen in custody are being asked to hand over assets. Settlements for royals are likely to also include pledges of loyalty to Prince Mohammed, the advisor said. Wow. So you've got to hand over your bucks, and then you also have to kiss Prince Mohammed's hand. Nice one, that. And the Financial Times said many of those detained were keen to secure their release by signing over cash and corporate assets. It quoted one person involved in the negotiations as saying, they are making settlements with most of those in the Ritz. Cough up the cash and you will go home. That's what this official said. Cough up the cash and you will go home. 70% of Saudi Arabia's population are under the age of 30. over the next decade, at least 5 million Saudis are likely to enter the workforce, posing an enormous problem for a government that does not currently have jobs to offer them. Whew! You've got a recession, and you've got a problem giving the young people, 70% of the population, right, the young people, and you have to give 5 million of them, 5 million of them over the next decade, jobs. Big headache. Big headache. Anyway. Right, so, let's see what else we got for you. I like that statement, by the way. Cough up the cash and go home. So there you are. A twist in the tail. Sure. You know what? I wonder if we can do that here in South Africa. Lock up all the big shot chores in the government at the Four Seasons Hotel in Johannesburg. That'll be nice, eh? Four Seasons Hotel in Johannesburg. And they will be told, pay back the money. Pay back the money and you can go home. Or maybe we will also take away your mansions. So then you can pay back the money and get some corrugated iron and make a nice John Doll for yourself. Dear listeners, do you think it will work here? But back to Saudi. There is talk that there is some close collaboration between the Saudis and Israel. Some of it under the table and some openly. And these days, Iran and the Saudis seem to share the same sentiments and objectives. Talking about the Saudi government. Hamas was declared a terrorist organization. The Muslim Brotherhood was declared a terrorist organization. And you know what? Israel just loves it. Loves it. Here's something from the British Telegraph newspaper. Israel's top military commander has given an unprecedented interview to a Saudi website, offering to share intelligence between the Jewish state and the Arab regional power in a joint effort to counter Iran. Stand up to Iran. Lieutenant General Ghadi Eisenkot told the Saudi-owned ELF news site that Saudi Arabia and Israel, two countries that do not have formal diplomatic relations, should work together in a new international alliance against Iran. He said, "We are ready to exchange experiences with moderate Arab countries and exchange intelligence to confront Iran. We are ready to share information if necessary. There are many common interests between us and them." The general's words and his decision to grant the interview to an Arab outlet show the growing convergence between Saudi Arabia and Israel over their shared alarm at Iran's influence in the Middle East. And hours earlier, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, Abdul al-Jubair, lambasted both Iran and Hezbollah, the Lebanese militant group which is backed by Iran and seen as a mortal enemy by Israel. So Mr. Jubair said, "Hezbollah is a grade A terrorist organization." And these words match Israel's description of the group. He continued, "Wherever we see a problem, we see Hezbollah act as an arm or agent of Iran, and this has to come to an end." Under the leadership of its aggressive young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia has tried to counter Iran across the region. For the last 2 years, it has been fighting in Yemen against the Houthi rebels who are aligned with Iran, and recently accused Iran and Hezbollah of helping the Houthis to fire a missile at Riyadh Airport. Saudi Arabia has led a blockade against its neighbor Qatar, partly over the Emirates' ties with Iran, and many suspect Riyadh forced Saad Hariri, the Lebanese prime minister, to resign as a way of countering Hezbollah's influence in the Lebanese government. The Trump administration is eager to see Israel and Saudi Arabia, who are both American allies, work together against Iran. General Eisenkot said Donald Trump's presidency created an opportunity to build a new international coalition in the region. Wow. So, dear listeners, the bottom line is that Saudi Arabia is ready to target Israel's enemies, and so eventually, as President Pagla, that's our Donald, says, there will be a new international coalition built in the region with Israel and the so-called moderate Muslim countries being united in some sort of a Gulf Cooperation Council, a new GCC. There you have it. A nightmare that's slowly becoming a reality. And of course, we had the foot-in-mouth statement from the Imam of the Haram. Well, that's how it's been reported, that Abdul Rahman Al-Sudais said in a TV interview with Saudi channel Al-Ikbariya that Saudi Arabia and the United States are the, in his words, poles of influence in the world. He said they are steering the world and humanity to the ports of security, peace and prosperity, claiming that the two countries should unite to combat terrorism and to realize security and international peace. Wow! Sudais, what do you think of that? He said that the United States and Saudi Arabia are steering the world and humanity to the ports of security, peace and prosperity, and that the two countries should unite to combat terrorism and to realize security and international peace. Magic stuff, isn't it? Dear readers, if you believe that the United States is steering the world to peace and prosperity, then may I respectfully suggest that I am sure that you are smoking something, and that stuff is not legal. And you know what, speaking about smoking, listen to this. The United States has spent nearly $8.6 billion. Did you get that? $8.6 billion. I think when you're listening to this program, you better have your calculators next to you. Because every time I mention dollars, you multiply it by 14. The United States has spent nearly $8.6 billion in interdicting and eradicating opium production in Afghanistan. $8.6 billion to stop opium production in Afghanistan. That's what they have spent so far. Despite U.S. efforts, cultivation of poppy has steadily increased in Afghanistan since the U.S. invasion in 2001. Cultivation of poppy. I wonder if that name is still popular in Gauteng. Because every third person I met, young lady I met, her name was Poppy. So, I wonder if that name is still popular there. because you get opium out of poppy. So despite U.S. efforts, cultivation of poppy has steadily increased in Afghanistan since the U.S. invasion in 2001. Now, listen to this. Opium production is up, has gone up 87% in Afghanistan this year to a record level of 9,000 tons. 9,000 tons. That is 4,200 tons more than 2016. Almost doubled opium production. According to a recent report from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. You know DOC. You know UNODC, that's what it's called. And it says here that Afghanistan remains the world's largest opium producer and exporter, producing an estimated 80% of the world's opium. 80%. This year's opium production equates to 7% of Afghanistan's estimated GDP. GDP. 7% of Afghanistan's estimated GDP. Or if you translate that, what is that equivalent to? $1.39 billion, according to this United Nations report. Fabulous, isn't it? Fabulous stuff. So, there you have it. And now we are running out of time. So I think I'll go straight. I got a whole lot of other stuff to discuss, but it's going to take too much of time. So let me go directly to the light at the end of the tunnel. You know, let me tell you something. Robert Mugabe is actually a very, very bright fellow. He's got a string of degrees. And in the early 90s, I was in London. And I heard him on, I saw him on BBC. And he was talking about how he's going to liberate his country and talking about white domination. He was so articulate, so eloquent in his speech that I actually applauded him. I said, this guy is so fantastic. He's amazing. He's a bright guy. He's an intellectual. He's so caring and compassionate. He is a true leader. And when he goes to Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe will be progressing, prospering like you can't believe. That's what I thought in those early 1970s when Mugabe was in exile in London. And then he came back and Zimbabwe went straight into the toilet. So as I said, he's got a lot of degrees. He's also quite witty, actually. Sometimes what he says is intentionally funny, and sometimes it's not. Here is a sample of his sayings. He said, South Africans will kick down a statue of a dead white man, but won't even attempt to slap a live one. Yet they can stone to death a black man simply because he's a foreigner. Nice one, that, eh? I think it's nice. It's about, what's that? Xenophobia. South Africans will kick down a statue of a dead white man, but won't even attempt to slap a live one. Yet, they can stone to death a black man simply because he's a foreigner. Here's another one of Mugabe's saying. Sometimes you look back at girls you spend money on, rather than send it to your mum, and then you realize witchcraft is real. So he's bewitched. You spend money on the girls instead of giving it to your mother. Sometimes you look back at girls you spend money on rather than send it to your mom, and you realize witchcraft is real. He says, yeah, our economy is 100 times better than the average African economy. Outside South Africa, what country is Zimbabwe? What is lacking now are goods on the shelves. That is all. If that's an indication of the economy, then I don't know. Just no problem with the economy, only there are no goods on the shelves. What a mampara. And he says, this is a killer. This is a killer. He says, if President Barack Obama wants me to allow marriage for same-sex couples in my country, he must come here so that I can marry him. Now, this one really killed me. Eh? I fell off my chair laughing. You know, sometimes if you want to do some jadu, curse somebody, you take something of theirs. you take something of this, maybe nail filings or something. You heard all these stories before, you know. You take something of this. And this one, I tell you, I laughed till I fell off my chair. This is what Mugabe said. He says, it's hard to bewitch African girls these days, because each time you take a piece from her hair to the witch doctor, either a Brazilian innocent woman gets mad or a factory in China catches fire. Because you're taking your hair from the wig. this Robert Fuller is a character. Right, let me finish off with a couple of fast ones here. The best slogan on a t-shirt. Please do not disturb me. I am married and already very disturbed. And here's the last one. Ronnie from Mirbank ended up in ICU once again. And Gulambai said, "Hey, Ronnie, what happened this time, eh?" And Ronnie replied, "Hey, what am I tell you, Gulu? Pushpa asked me, shall I prepare curry or soup today? And I answered her, first make it, we will name it later. Hey, boss, the pots came flying from the air, man." This is David Dawsey bidding you all, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.